We're talking about grassroots efforts in Milwaukee to manage water resources in a sustainable and resilient way and give residents a voice in the work. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The nonprofit Milwaukee Water Commons is working to transform the city's water future. It has a vision to help the city become a model water city, and it involves climate work, it involves public health, environmental justice. Do you have access to waterways for recreation, or do you feel unwelcome enjoying our state's rivers and lakes? Are you worried about water pollution in the waterways around you? It's 800-642-1234. Brenda Coley is co-executive director of Milwaukee Water Commons. Brenda, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
Well, introduce us to Milwaukee Water Commons. What is your mission? What is at the heart of your work?
Well, Milwaukee Water Commons is a grassroots nonprofit organization that really works on behalf of the water to steward and shepherd the water. And we believe that everyone has a right to share in the benefits of the water. And also to care for it as well.
What do you see as the biggest threats facing our water, especially where you are in Milwaukee?
I would probably say there's two things, and we talk about people and planet. So we're talking about water quality, which is, pollutants, legacy pollutants in the water. And then we talk about the fact that we have 70,000 lead laterals in the city that make the people of Milwaukee at risk for lead poisoning. So we're talking really about water quality as being at risk. But, we look at water in a much, I'd say, more broader way. We're talking about we created a 6-point water city agenda because our city was positioning itself as a water-centric city, and we wondered what it would be like if the community was in the center of this discussion around water. So we interviewed close to 2,000 people in small groups and one-on-one and came up with a water city agenda. So we're talking about practices for becoming really a model water city. And we have, and our initiatives and our agenda is blue-green jobs, water quality, drinking water, arts and culture is a part of that, education and recreation, and then green infrastructure.
Yeah, we're going to unpack blue-green jobs and elsewhere in this agenda. But do you find, over the course of these thousands of interviews that business and industry are at the table to guide water policy decisions, but where are residents in this mix?
Well, I think that is changing, but it's not perfect. And we really want to elevate the voices of the community to be equal to academia and to business. Not to say that business and academia don't have any, or government don't have any say-so in this, but we need to all have our voices, have the community's voices elevated. So, things are changing. People are beginning to understand and see the gift of water and our responsibility to take care of it, because we only have this much water. It's not growing anymore. We have what we have. So we have to steward it, and we have responsibility to pass it on to the next generation.
You mentioned lead pipes and the estimated 70,000 lead pipes that need to be replaced. And, this will take generations at the pace the city is trying to do this. Why do you think there isn't more urgency on this issue?
Well, I think part of it is resources, the finances to do so. So, unfortunately, we're looking at a huge infrastructure package coming down from the federal government. We have money coming from the state in the governor's budget for lead laterals. So I'm hoping I'm beginning to see some movement in that direction.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Brenda Coley, who's co-executive director of Milwaukee Water Commons. It's a nonprofit working to protect the water, working with residents. Do you live near water? Have you noticed rising water levels or increased flooding? Do you worry about your safety of your drinking water? What about PFAS or lead pipes, farm runoff? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. WPR.org. Over the course of these interviews with residents, Brenda, what were the concerns that kept coming up again and again? What are the big issues with residents and their water?
I think that people in the community, and this has changed. We did these interviews in 2016, so we know a lot more than we did in 2016. At that time, the conversation on water was not really robust, and people weren't really attuned to some of the issues and situations. We're very lucky in Milwaukee and Wisconsin in the Great Lakes region because we have this beautiful, we live on the Great Lakes. We have Lake Michigan in Milwaukee, you know, Superior up north. We have Three Rivers in our city. So we have a water. So I think that people are now beginning, not only do we have the water, we have this gift of water, we also have a responsibility to take care of it, and that people, you know, should enjoy the benefits of the water. So I think that that's becoming resonating more and more with the community.
Let's bring in Jacqueline, who's joining us from Williams Bay. Hi, Jacqueline. What would you like to add?
Hi there. Thanks for having me on. I was just inquiring, how come animal agriculture and animal aquaculture is being so widely ignored and not addressed as the root cause of pollution to our waters, land, and air here in Wisconsin?
Jacqueline, thank you. What is the impact there of agriculture, Brenda, and why isn't this at the forefront?
I think part of it is really people do better when they know better. And I don't feel that people are as tuned into some of our lifestyle practices as really being detrimental to our water. So we have big ag runoff, right? These huge farms, you know, and then we have small farmers also who are trying to make a living with the water. So we have to really educate ourselves and educate our farmers. And then we have to put regulations in to talk about how we deal with runoff from large animals. We eat a lot of meat, and meat needs places to graze, you know, and so that's part of the issue.
Is the issue also CAFOs, these large animal operations that you see around the state? How does your organization look at CAFOs?
Well, you know, we think that this is a problem and an issue that we need to really put our heads together and figure out. But these big CAFOs are a problem. We've got to figure out how to deal with those kinds of runoffs. And this is really has to do a lot with regulation, because in many ways, individual people don't have the power to do anything. So it's really talking about holding our government responsible to do this. We, you know, one of the things that Milwaukee Water Commons talks about is the fact that we are holding this in commons. And so we look for our government really to hold our public lands in trust for us on our behalf. And I think we just have to hold our government accountable to those issues.
Brenda, how has the past year with this pandemic highlighted how important water is for people?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that, you know, since we've had to socially isolate, we've seen many more people really take advantage of the waterways and really find themselves, you know, getting solace from nature. So we really have to, so water quality has become a huge issue because we want the water to be safe for people to go into. So the pandemic has really shown us, it's taught us many lessons that, you know, our nature and water is very important to our health and well-being, and that we have a responsibility towards that. And that's what we're talking about, stewarding, you know, our water. And I think people are getting that as they've spent more times outdoors because we've had to socially mm-hmm. isolate.
Brenda Coley with us, who leads Milwaukee Water Commons. It's a nonprofit working on collaborations to protect water. Do you live near water? Have you noticed rising water levels or increased flooding? Do you think Wisconsin and the federal government could do more to protect water and build equality around this precious resource? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Brenda Coley here on the Ideas Network. You're with us as we discuss Milwaukee's water future and how to ensure all residents have a stake in the health of their waters. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Milwaukee Water Commons was formed in 2015, and over the years, it's worked on a transformative water agenda, putting collaboration at the heart of its work, and we're learning from their steps. Do you have access to waterways for recreation, or do you feel unwelcome enjoying our state's rivers and lakes? Can you swim? Do you feel safe enjoying the water? Join in 800-642-1234. Brenda Coley is co-executive director of Milwaukee Water Commons, and Brenda is with us for 10 more minutes. You mentioned earlier blue-green jobs, and this is an element that Milwaukee Water Commons is working on. What are blue-green jobs?
Well, we're really talking about jobs in the water sector in the city of Milwaukee, and we're in particularly looking at jobs that are living wage jobs and jobs that don't necessarily require an advanced degree. And we're really looking to see if these jobs are equitably distributed throughout the whole city. And this is what we mean when we say that the water, that we have to steward the water and that we should all share in the benefits of the water. So Milwaukee Water Commons, in partnership with the U.S. Water Alliance and both of our water utilities, formed a water equity task force that met for about a year and a half to 2 years to look at water equity issues in our city.
What might these jobs entail? What would they look like?
Well, I mean, they're jobs in the wastewater industry. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about the laying of the pipes and cleaning the water to make sure that when it goes back out into Lake Michigan, it's clean for us to use it. And then we're talking about all the jobs that are associated with bringing drinking water to our community.
Let's bring in Matt now in Madison. Matt, hi, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for having me on this morning. I was calling mostly just to express my concern living in Madison, Wisconsin, with these kind of smaller lakes and runoff from the city, how it can negatively affect just the swimming areas. We have lots of blue-green algae. We've had more repeated flooding in the area, and I recognize this isn't exactly Milwaukee, but I'm wondering what sort of small or short-term solutions can be done to preserve that, to feel safe going swimming, and how can we protect these water reservoirs for future generations to enjoy?
Matt, thank you. Brenda, go ahead.
Well, I would say that that the goal is, because of climate change, is really to try and capture the water where it falls. So that's one of the things that contributes to flooding and polluting of our waterways. So we have initiatives, and you've probably heard the term green infrastructure, where we are relying on really the natural world to capture water. So that would mean we would plant rain gardens, which include plants that are native to the area, and they can absorb the water. We're looking at really enhancing the tree canopy, which helps with absorbing water. And then we have to be careful with what we really put down our drains. We shouldn't put medication down our drains. We should think about those kinds of things, and also during big rain events, not to use water if it's not necessary, so that then the system can deal with the amount of water that's happening. So there's rain barrels, there's capturing the water where it's at, and we do that by having less lawn and more native plants, and then being careful and educating ourselves on what goes into our drains.
You also have looked at water recreation as an equity issue. Not all Milwaukee residents have access to enjoy the pools and the water. What is your take on that?
Well, we have a history of segregation in our state, and in particularly in Milwaukee, and that has also affected people's access to the waterways. So, for example, when you talk about pools, many of the pools in the city of Milwaukee have closed. Young people and adults don't know how to swim. And so we look at it sort of like a big donut hole. And in the center of the city where there used to be many natatoriums and places to swim, they're not, they've since really the 40s and 50s and 60s, they've been closed. So that's one of the issues around recreation. You know, it's an environmental justice if you can't get to the water, right, and recreate. And then when we get to the water, there's pollution. And so there's like a double injustice going on. So I think that, you know, we have the opportunity to really open up the access to our waterways so that that's really a place where we can experience some public desegregated kind of areas and arenas.
How do you do that? How do you open up access?
Well, you open up the roadways, for example, in Milwaukee to get to the lakefront for people. There's no public transportation. So you have public transportation available so that people can get down to the waterways. And you also teach people how to be there safely. Mm-hmm. So Milwaukee Water Commons, along with Sea Grant and the Sailing Center, is having a beach ambassador program. And this is where we're really, in the summer, we're going to have young people really to talk with people on the lakefront about water quality and keeping yourself safe in Lake Michigan.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Brenda Coley, who's co-executive director of Milwaukee Water Commons. Do you live in Milwaukee, maybe Sturgeon Bay or another waterfront community? What have you noticed in the effects of your water and what you see in terms of access to enjoy it? 800-642-1234. John is joining us from Boaz. Hi, John.
Good morning. I am a native of Milwaukee, and I know Milwaukee has Lake Michigan, and so does Chicago, and all the way around the lake, and Lake Superior, Lake Huron. All those lakes, we get 40 inches of rain. We need to protect our water and don't give it away to Waukesha, which goes down the Mississippi River shed. Don't give it to California. Right now in the supermarkets, $1.50 a gallon. If nuclear fusion works, they're going to be needing water more than oil.
Okay, John, thank you. And so John is really saying that to keep your water local and to not ship it to other places. Brenda, what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, we think that diversion of water is a very sensitive and important issue. Everyone has the right to clean drinking water. And we believe that really water should not be moved. So if it's in a particular watershed, it really shouldn't be moved to another. But we believe that everyone has to have water. So it really depends on the circumstances, whether or not. And it shouldn't be for profit, and it shouldn't be for commerce, right? It should be for the fact that people need drinking water. And then there's some responsibility on how they take care of that water if it has to be diverted. Will it be cleaned? How will it be cleaned? Who will do the cleaning? Who will be responsible for it? So those are all kinds of issues around, water diversion. And it's a complicated issue.
Gary is joining us from Chicago this morning. Gary, hi.
Yeah, that's Carrie with a T. How you doing?
Oh, hi, Carrie. Sorry about that.
Don't worry about it. Hey, listen, my it's a twofold thing because I'm a licensed plumber, and we're taught certain things about protecting our waterfront, protecting people's lives, okay? So my question was, with the lead services that I heard mentioned on your program, why didn't they 60 years ago realize that the calcium deposit inside the lead service would deteriorate due to the material that's in the water, the minerals that are in the water to break down those products? They were claiming all all the time that it's the lead in the paint that was causing children to have disorders when they were drinking the disorder.
Mm. Brenda, why couldn't this have been remedied at the inception when they knew what the lead would do to people?
You know, I'm not sure if I would like to think that it wasn't an intentional thing, that they felt that the lead would stay intact. Mm-hmm. But we've come to know now that if you disturb the pipes in any way, then the lead can flake off and then go into the drinking water. So I would like to think that this was not an intentional thing. And after the 60s, they really stopped using lead in pipes for drinking water. But before that, they did. So where these lead laterals are concentrated are in old housing stock. And, you know, we won't be surprised to know that that's where the majority of people of color, at least in Milwaukee, live within this old housing stock.
So Brenda, thank you for joining us. Brenda Coley, co-executive director of Milwaukee Water Commons on the Ideas Network. We're talking about water and creating ocean sustainability while being mindful of social justice. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is extremely important work because scientists tell us the ocean absorbs more than 90% of excess heat caused by emissions and generates half of the oxygen we breathe. But our oceans are threatened. They're threatened by overfishing, habitat destruction, pollution, and the loss of biodiversity. What questions do you have about our oceans and their health? It's 800-642-1234. Marine biologist Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson is founder and CEO of Ocean Collective. It's a consulting firm for conservation solutions grounded in social justice, and co-founder of Urban Ocean Lab, a think tank for coastal cities. Ayanna, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, here you are, the daughter of a high school teacher turned family farmer with humane mm-hmm. treatment of chickens and an architect and potter. What attracted you to studying oceans and marine biology?
I love being introduced by my professional lineage. I think the combination of expertise that my parents have certainly informed so much about me, obviously. I grew up in Brooklyn and never thought of New York as a coastal city until I had already gotten a PhD in marine biology and moved back because we're so sort of separated from nature here, many of us. But I had the chance to go on a family vacation as a kid to Florida and learn to swim and just completely fell in love with the ocean. I saw a coral reef through the bottom of a glass-bottom boat, and I was just enamored with this whole other world underwater. And of course, once I learned it was threatened, wanted to figure out how I could help protect it.
When you say that, seeing it through the glass bottom boat, I just, I remember the first time my children saw that in Key Largo in the coral mm-hmm. there, and they were we were all just blown away. Can you give us a health report? What is the state of our oceans now?
Oof. I think what I didn't know in 1985 when I was in Key West looking at that reef was that, you know, coral reefs were falling apart. You know, they were dying as I was falling in love with them. And, you know, if global climate change, if the temperature rises 1.5 degrees Celsius above, you know, the historical average or 2 degrees, we could really lose most of the coral reefs on this planet. And we're already over 1.1 degrees Celsius of warming. So we're well on our way. And that's heartbreaking to me, not just because of their beauty, but because there are hundreds of millions of people who depend on them for their nutrition, for their livelihoods, for their cultures. And coral reefs are only like sort of the most colorful example, literally. I think so much is at stake, as you mentioned in your introduction, also the ways in which the ocean is a major component of our climate system, that the ocean has absorbed not just 90% of the heat, but about a third of all the carbon dioxide we've emitted by burning fossil fuels, which has just completely changed the chemistry of seawater on the entire planet, which is mind-boggling. It's about 30% more acidic now than it was 50 or 100 years ago. So, so much has changed. You mentioned overfishing and habitat destruction and pollution, and all of those things are true, but and really quite dire. But I don't want people to focus only on the threats to the ocean, because the ocean is not just a victim of sort of the worst of humanity. It's also very much a hero. When I think of the role the ocean can play in climate policy, I mean, this is why I co-created the Blue New Deal, to think about how the ocean could be part of our climate solutions at a policy level. How do we push for renewable energy offshore, wind turbines and floating solar panels and tidal and wave energy? And how do we protect coastal ecosystems that are protecting shorelines from storms and absorbing all this carbon and providing habitat for baby fish? How do we think about farming in the ocean in a way that's regenerative and absorbs carbon and provides habitat and fosters biodiversity through growing seaweed and shellfish? Like, all of these things are possible. And so, yes, the threats are real and extremely dire, but there's also so much we can focus on as far as solutions. So I think it's important not to lose sight of that piece, too.
And I know you tell students to plot out a Venn diagram to see how your talents and your aptitudes and your interests can intersect to solve these really big problems that, you know, the ocean may seem a world away. So even though we're not in school, should we be mindful of our own Venn diagram in looking at these problems?
Oh, sure. It's something I do, and I don't plan to go back to school. I think I'm done. So the Venn diagram that you mentioned is something that I've sort of come to as an answer for all the young people who ask me when I go and speak at universities, what can I do? Like, how do I figure out where I fit into all of this? And at first I would just say, I don't know, what are you good at? Like, do that thing, right? We need, like, if we think about the climate crisis as a moment where we need transformation, that means we need to change our electricity and our transportation and our agriculture and land use, our buildings, our manufacturing, right? Like, that's going to take every skill. So what are you good at? And then, like, how can you apply that to the work that needs doing? And so the work that needs doing is sort of the second circle of the three-circle Venn diagram that I have in mind. You know, what skills, what magic, what resources are you bringing to the table? Which climate solutions do you want to put your energy towards? And then the third circle is what brings you joy? Because I think this is the work of our lifetimes, right? Like, there's no reason it has to be miserable. We can pick the thing to contribute to that will get us out of bed in the morning. So being at the epicenter of that Venn diagram is what I recommend for everyone. So, yeah, bust out your colored pencils and see what that means for you.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, co-founder of the Urban Ocean Lab, a think tank devoted to help coastal communities adapt to climate change. You can join in. Do you fish for a living? Are you worried that we're depleting our lakes and oceans of this food source? And what can be done about it? Join in 800-642-1234. Tiran is joining us in Toma. Hi, Tiran. Go ahead.
Hi, I just had a question. I heard of this new body preservation method for when a loved one departs. What you can do is you can cremate their body, and they take those ashes and put them inside this dome that they leave underwater, and this dome can grow new coral for the fish. So you can, like, put it in an ocean and visit the ocean to commemorate them. So I'm just wondering if this cremation dome is a good way to maybe help reintroduce coral back to where it belongs.
Ayanna, have you heard of this?
I have heard of this. I don't know a ton about it, but to zoom out for a second on the big picture, one of the main ways that people do restoration of coral reefs, try to help them grow back and recover, is by putting out essentially these different sorts of, like, concrete structures that will attract baby corals to settle and grow on them and sort of help create this nice habitat for corals. And corals grow, like, often about a centimeter a year. So it takes a long time to see that kind of recovery. And I've heard of, you know, this company, or maybe there are multiple companies that sort of mix cremated ashes in with the concrete as they're doing this restoration. So I think I don't know that there's like a downside to it per se, but it's not going to like save, this is not the thing that's going to save the ocean. Mm. But yeah, I'd have to look into the details of it, but in general, it doesn't sound like a bad thing. It's a way people can connect with, connect with the ocean and express their care for their loved ones. So, I don't know enough details about
sure.
it to give like a real response, but coral reef restoration is something that there are a lot of scientists really working on. What would that entail? Because they are in fact just so deeply threatened.
Can we talk about fishing for a moment? Millions of people depend on the oceans for their livelihoods, for fishing, but we've overfished or completely fished almost 94% of the ocean's fish populations. What can be done about this?
So this is a huge question. Yes, I think it's important to know that when we talk about fishing and overfishing, there's two major different types of fishing, right? There's sort of the small scale, more artisanal fishing that many people might picture when you think about fishing, a few people in a boat with some lines or some net, just having a catch of the day scenario. But most of the fish that's, and about half of the fish globally is still caught in these smaller scale methods. That's what's contributing to food security and most of the jobs in fishing around the world, especially in the tropics. But then you have this like large industrial fishing with these huge tanker ships and like onboard freezers and processing factory facilities. And that's just a whole different ballgame, right? And they can stay out there for weeks or months and their nets, when they're using nets, they're like as big as football fields and they can catch just huge amounts of marine life. So, and in that scenario, there's obviously a dire need to rein that in, right? Mm-hmm. Thinking about, you know, the analog with catching wild animals on land, we don't expect to just be able to like eat lions and, you know, savanna animal, wild animals as our major source of protein. It just doesn't make sense, right? They can't reproduce as fast as we can eat them. And that's true for the animals on the top of the food chain. For people who want to eat seafood, I always recommend going really low on the food chain, those tiny fish that reproduce quickly, sardines and anchovies. But really the opportunity is for farmed shellfish and seaweed. That's the most sustainable option. I mean, these are things that you can farm, you can replenish them. They don't need to be fed. They don't need fertilizer or fresh water. They just grow off the nutrients in the seawater and sunlight. So definitely we need to rein in overfishing. Small scale fishing can cumulatively have a huge impact. The large industrial fishing also. And there are, you know, that's the role of policy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people, the role of the consumer obviously is there too, and as citizens to push for these things. But it's really important to think about, like, that's what laws are for, to prevent these things. It shouldn't be on you when you're in the grocery store to figure out, like, what does all this mean? And do I have to, like, spend an hour Googling before I get to decide? Like, endangered stuff should not be in the supermarket for us to be choosing among. So I think, and you know, about a third of seafood is mislabeled. So even if you do all your homework, you can still get it wrong. So this is why I've been so deeply involved in ocean policy for all of my career, to make sure that we have the right rules in place to manage the ocean better and to think about the ocean as a place of wildlife, not just a place of how can we maximally extract everything.
Yeah. Let's bring in John in Westfield with a question. Hi, John. Go ahead. John, are you there? Yeah, go ahead.
I think so. I worked for the Minnesota Zoo for quite some time, and we took a lot of krill in to feed a lot of our fish, and I now work with trout in Westfield. And we've got people wanting here to buy our groundwater, our artesian springs. They come from Aquafina, they come from Nestle, they come from all over the world. It's the last of the 1% drinkable, potable water. And it's becoming an issue with the neighbors. They actually get it, but I don't know if the rest of the world does. And working with aqua, I was in Key West the same time you were in Key West, Iwana. And it was terrible. They dredged up so much silt that went into the Key West Aquarium. We couldn't keep up with it. It was just, it was horrible. But we did manage to keep sea life alive and exhibits alive. But
So, John, there, you know, really talking about, you know, also the recreation here of going to zoos and keeping aquatic life in captivity. Yeah. What are your thoughts?
I decided to become a marine biologist in part because of visiting aquariums, right? I think they can be really wonderful experiences for people. I held a sea urchin in my hand when I was 5 and was just like completely blown away by this creature and all its tube feet crawling around. Obviously, like, large marine mammals in captivity is a ridiculous thing, in my opinion, that we should stop doing. But, you know, sea urchins and fish and stuff like that, I think there's a bit of a distinction there in terms of, are we able to provide these things with the kind of habitats that that they would be comfortable in? But, you know, to the point that was raised about drinking water, I think that's a really important thing to think about too. Like, are we prioritizing water globally? This is the trend that's happening, as he described. And I think that's something to be really concerned about, making sure that people have access to clean, safe, free drinking water. Like, access to clean water is a human right. So making sure that's not something that is just like bottled up and sold back to us, I think is really important to keep your eye on. So I'm glad that that John and his neighbors are thinking about that.
Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson with us, founded Ocean Collective and co-founded the Urban Ocean Lab. What questions do you have about the vulnerability of our oceans and marine protected areas? Do you think fishing should be stopped in some areas or banning the removal of corals? What actions or do you want to see on ocean conservation? Still time to talk about this. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Ayanna Johnson here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation on ocean sustainability and what comes next for protection. The United Nations has declared 2021 to 2030 the decade of ocean science for sustainable development in response to mounting threats to the ocean. Marine biologist Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson is CEO of Ocean Collective, and she's with us for 10 more minutes. David is joining us from Ironwood, Michigan this morning. Hi, David. What is on your mind with oceans?
I agree with your guess. I mean, we need to protect the oceans. I saw this one article. I know she might know more about it. One of the earlier mass extinctions was because of oceans, the oxygen level get too low, and then the fish die, and then the anaerobic bacteria that's in the seabed moved up into the ocean and, you know, literally, the oceans quit making as much oxygen. That's a doomsday scenario. But, and then I saw this other article about how the forest helps prevent droughts and floods. Big, huge forests move water around the planet and stuff, and really cuts down that, and it helps clean the water. I mean, there should be no water shortages if we keep it clean, but we're polluting it. It's just, like I said, I agree 100% with your guess.
Yeah, David, thank you for that. And, you know, David, reflecting on the mass extinctions and what that can tell us today, Ayanna.
So one of sort of the phenomenon that he's describing is what we see with dead zones, which is, you know, one of the ways in which the Midwest has a huge effect on the ocean is through the Mississippi River, right? Mm-hmm. As all of the agriculture happening in the Midwest and the use of excess fertilizers and pesticides runs down streams to rivers, to the Gulf, to the ocean. When it gets to the Gulf, it can cause what's called dead zones. And so all of that excess nutrients from fertilizers lead to this explosion in the growth of algae. And that algae, as it dies and sinks, creates these anaerobic conditions down near the seafloor, which is basically like low or no oxygen scenario. And then obviously the fish and stuff that are trying to live in there, the fish can hopefully swim away if the dead zone isn't too big, but all of the, you know, crabs and things living on the bottom, shrimp don't fare as well. Mm. So, and we have annual dead zones now, because of the combination of climate impacts as well as, pollution that's running into the ocean. So that is in fact something to be concerned about, especially because as the waters get warmer, fish need more oxygen metabolically. So you have warm water that's like by its own chemistry able to hold less oxygen. And then you have less oxygen because of these dead zones, which is a pretty terrible combination of things. So, so yes, we need to think about how land and sea are connected and how important it is to shift the way we do agriculture as a major part of how we protect the ocean. And the Biden administration has committed to something called 30 by 30, which is short for protecting 30% of nature by 2030. And that is a real opportunity to think about what would it mean to protect and restore all these ecosystems, including the ocean and coastal ecosystems. And they've also committed to setting up a civilian climate corps through the Department of Interior, which would help people get jobs and get back to work after this recession by doing that work of protecting and restoring ecosystems. So I like to always remind folks that the solutions to climate change are not just engineering and technological, right? It's not just solar panels and electric cars. It's regenerative agriculture. It's protecting and restoring ecosystems that are absorbing all of this carbon instead of releasing it. And there are just so many solutions at our fingertips. And that's, I think, the thing we need to focus on, like which piece of this are you going to work on?
Getting back to that Venn diagram.
Yeah. And I think it's not just, is it as your full-time job, but what does this mean for your volunteer work? How you show up in your family and your community as a citizen with your sports team or your religious community in your school? There's so much that needs to change. So I hope that folks are starting to think about how they can jump in and be part of these solutions.
Ayanna, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson is a marine biologist, policy expert, author, CEO of Ocean Collective. We'll speak Thursday evening at 6:30 as part of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies Earth Day program. And you hear her on the Ideas Network.